my head many years from now. Will you still be sending me a valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Dr. Rob Stahl bringing you the only local call-in radio program exclusively for older adults and caregivers. What should you expect at your age? The answer is a lot, and that's what we're here to explain. It's Monday, March 7, 2005, and welcome to today's show. Last month, we discussed sleep problems and dream interpretation with Dr. Alex Gelfer and Professor Linda Zemmel. If you missed the show, you can hear it again from the show's website, whatshouldyouexpect.com. All one word, except for the dot. I'm happy to have with me today physician Dr. Evan Calkins, an internist, rheumatologist, and geriatrician. The man introduced me to and fostered me through my geriatric training. Also with me is Mrs. Beverly Kubala, an RN registered nurse who currently serves as president of the Network in Aging of Western New York, an organization that Dr. Calkins co-founded in the 1980s. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Let's get the mic a little bit closer to Dr. Calkins to ensure that we'll hear him. Here we go. The topic for today is the past, present, and future of geriatric care. The phone number for your calls is 855-6848, and we're all here to answer your questions. In an American Geriatric Society publication entitled Why Geriatrics as a Career Choice, I found the following quotation. Having played roles as a general physician, rheumatologist, and academic administrator, I find that the practice of geriatrics and the varied issues that surround this practice is the most challenging and rewarding aspect of my medical career. Dr. Calkins, let me ask you, who spoke those words or who wrote those words? And please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became who I and many others consider to be the father of geriatric medicine in Western New York. You're on, Dr. Calkins.
Well, when I you treated me to a typed line or two of how the show was to begin, and I was startled to read that quote, and then even more startled to discover that I was the person that had said it. But I think that it is correct statement. I'm really not the father of geriatrics. I should mention, and I can't remember his name, that when I became interested in switching my career into the field of geriatrics, there already was a physician here that had made a commitment to geriatrics and was the medical director of the Rosa Copeland Home, and also who had a geriatric clinic at the E.J. Meyer Memorial Hospital. And I don't know if any of us remember, it's too bad I can't remember his name, because he really was the father of geriatrics in Buffalo, and I came along afterwards.
You carried the torch very well, and I stand corrected, and I'll have to do some more research to find out exactly who that was.
Well, I had been in Buffalo at that point since 1960. I've been in Buffalo for 17 years it was, really, as head of the Department of Medicine at the university and at the Buffalo General, and then we became combined with the Meyer Hospital, and also the VA was involved, and we had a coordinated program, and we had a very exciting time of it. And I worked with colleagues in developing a fairly classic Department of Medicine with a good base in research and teaching at all levels and this and that. And it was quite successful. But I was puzzled as to what to do next. And a friend of mine named Alan Dixon, who had been a visiting professor in Buffalo, and I have known since I was working in Boston, and he was also with me at that point. He's a British physician. He said that he was the number two man in his class at Cambridge Medical School, but the top man had gone into the field of geriatrics and set up a program in Hastings, England, and that if I was interested in seeing what geriatrics was like, I should go and visit him, which I did. And I began to see the possibilities of focusing programs and focusing interest and attention for what is required for older people, how different it is from the classic modes of practice, and a field that I thought was going to come on like gangbusters here in this country with the increasing population of older people. And so we did start a division of geriatrics, and it was the seventh such division in the in America to get started. And as you know yourself, because you were one of our first fellows, we had quite a good time, and I think made some good strides in the field.
It was a good time, and I still remember you putting your arm around me when I was doing a rotation at the VA during my training and saying, Rob, how about geriatrics as a field, and why don't you give up that radiology and think about geriatrics field for you? And it did fit me.
I found that in looking for people that might be interested in geriatrics, I looked especially for people who had in their adolescent years an image of what they wanted to do in life, and they had a vision of what they wanted to do with practice and with what they wanted to do for patients and the kind of role they wanted to lead. And then they got buffeted and beaten up by the established ladder of medicine and the very strict authoritarian concepts that were in place and so on, and quite discouraged. And I found if you could get them to recapture their enthusiasm and goals that they had as a young person, here was a field that would certainly capture the full energies of people that were committed in that type of a holistic direction, looking at patients as people and looking at them as people in a given environment and setting with families and with problems and with stories to tell. And we recruited a terrific group of young people into the field. We, by the time I finished as a head of that program, we had trained 10% of all of the fellowship-trained geriatricians in the United States of America.
Well,
in Buffalo, New York.
I'm proud to be one of them, and it was a tremendous effort on your part and foresight to see what was coming and what needed to be done. It certainly got me back on the right track, and I certainly don't regret.
Well, you've done a wonderful job, and you've pioneered many avenues of geriatrics, and we're proud of that.
Well, I'm going to keep on trying. Now, let's get to Bev. Now, Bev, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with geriatric care, and so involved that you rose to the presidency of our local network in aging.
Well, I wish I could say that I had a vision when I was an adolescent that I would be involved in geriatrics.
I don't know if I had that either, to tell you the truth, but Dr. Calkins found it in me.
Right. Well, you know, first I'd like to say that I'm honored to be here with Dr. Calkins, because certainly as the current president of the Network in Aging, Dr. Calkins is always someone who inspires all of us. Certainly the Network in Aging is a very unique organization. We're very fortunate to have it in Western New York. Because really what it does is it brings together so many different disciplines that are really involved in elder care. We bring healthcare systems, long-term care systems. We bring financial people. We bring attorneys. We bring people who work in senior citizen centers. So it's someone who really touches every aspect of a senior's life. And for my personal journey, you know, I really started out primarily in nursing. My background is nursing. I did the general acute care kind of thing, but then really took a sidestep over to alcoholism and drug dependency, and then I moved to home care, where I spent 15 years of my career. And primarily home care, certified home care, serves the elders in our community, helping them to be able to remain at home and to have a quality of life that they would enjoy. And then I moved to a long-term care setting, where I really worked with all of the different additional levels of care besides home care. and found that very exciting. And that brings me to now in my career, where I am a geriatric care manager within the law firm of Pfalzgraf Beinhauer Menzies. And I really do feel that it's a great blessing for me to be able to work with the group that I do, because they really do look holistically at all of their clients. And my role is to help them to have a high quality of life, however they choose to live it, and to be able to get them in contact with what resources are available in our community. Because I think one of the challenges that so many elders and their families face is they really don't know where to begin the journey. They know that things are starting to fall apart, but they don't really know where to start. So I help them to start the journey and hopefully to continue on a better journey so that it has higher quality.
Well, tremendous qualifications to be president of the network, and also the long-term care experience probably really focused the importance of the team approach to geriatric care. And one of the challenges is to bring that team approach to the fore in a community setting, not in one building as you have in a nursing home, mm-hmm. but how do you do it in a community where there are different groups, different buildings, different people spread out throughout the city?
Perhaps I could interject that hearing Bev describe her experiences and so on. When we started in geriatrics, it was perfectly clear that it was not a field that is based in intensive care units or in the classic structure of hospitals, that it was in fact based in the communities. That's where the action lies. I had a little difficulty persuading the people at the medical school that this was an appropriate direction for us to pursue, but I paid no attention to that.
You do have a mind of your own.
That's
what I like about you.
Pursue
Dr.
that
Hawkins.
Direction, and the question was how to do it. How do you how can you create an environment where people from this range of disciplines that you were describing will in fact communicate, work together, and develop a cohesive program which would make sense and is essential for a geriatric program. So at that point, my daughter, Lucy Calkins, that is quite a well-known in the field of elementary school reading and writing and so on, she had become familiar with a man at Yale named Seymour Saracen, who developed what he prescribed or espoused, what he described as environments for learning. And it did seem to me that what we needed in geriatrics wasn't people that would pump up the flat tire of a given problem in a sense, but people who would create an environment for self-learning and for teaching others, and an environment for learning. And he told me how to do it. A concept of community organization, which he describes as resource exchange, that you take a look at the things that you think you have to offer in a given partnership arrangement, mm-hmm. and then you go to somebody that you want to, you feel is going to be key to the collaborative program, and chat with them a while and find out what is their real goal that they perhaps haven't had the courage to express, and some of the things that they would need to achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. And in a little while, you find that some of the resources that you have would match the resources that the other person requires mm-hmm. to make the program begin to fit together, mm-hmm. so that people could work together in what Dr. Saracen described as resource exchange, each bringing the resources they already have, but willing to share them and use them in a way that will help other people. And that led to the development of the Network in Aging that objective.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Dr. Calkins, because that's really what the network does, is it connects us with so many disciplines that you wouldn't otherwise think would have an impact on elder care. But it, you know, whether it's the counselor or the social worker that works in a senior center, it's Meals on Wheels, it's the financial person, it's the attorney, it's everyone has sort of their little silo of information that they give to the senior. And seniors and their families spend a lot of time going to these different silos. But what they need is someone who can kind of bring it all together, or at least have the connections to be able to bring it all together so that it can really make sense to them and that they can then develop a plan. So that's the blessing of the network and what it's been for me, because it's really helped me to develop relationships in so many disciplines that if I had stayed in home care or just stayed in long-term care, I might not have developed those. So it's really part of our own professional development that we
While we're talking about the network, can you give us the web page of the network and also a phone number to call? If there are organizations out there, individuals that have particular expertise, and this discussion is putting a spark in their head how they can contribute to the effort, let's give them a way to contact you.
Sure. We have a website, and that's www.networkinaging.org. And just for their information, one of the things that we do is we sponsor educational forums. We are providing two seminars this spring dealing with the subject of spirituality and elder care. And that's certainly, we call it the missing piece in a very difficult puzzle. But it's one of the things that we've come to recognize that is something that is an important component of everyone's life, and especially as we age, spirituality can become increasingly important to us. But many professionals have a level of discomfort or uncomfortableness addressing those issues. So these seminars will be held in April and May, and you can go to our website to get more detailed information about that.
And they have what I would call dis-ease. It's a disease that the dis-ease that these practitioners have in dealing with spiritual matters. And we were talking before about a health fair that I helped conduct at a senior apartment building. And one of the questionnaires, there was a question. What helps keep you going? And one of the items to check off was faith. And about 40% of the people checked off that their faith helps keep them going. And whether they had the resources to fully express their faith and utilize their faith, I think it was very doubtful. So this seminar is very timely, and whoever can get there should. And
it's open to people, family members and others, as well as professionals, or what is this concept for these meetings?
It is primarily targeted to professionals who work in the field of elder care, but it's not strictly to clergy or anyone specifically related to spirituality, whether it's a social worker, a nurse, a case manager, certainly a physician. We have a number of very distinguished speakers on the program, so I think it'll be a wonderful program. And it really, you know, in my recent walk in care management, I've seen exactly the same thing, Dr. Stahl, where spirituality really keeps families going. And I've seen couples, senior couples, where one caregiver is doing what I would see as, from a nursing perspective, a huge job. They're just doing a monumental task of caring for their life partner towards the end of their life, and doing things that I would perceive as almost impossible for them to do. But they do it in part certainly because they love the person, but because their faith really sustains them through these trials and tribulations that they're going through together. So it really is an important aspect.
And it crosses all faiths. And we're not talking specifically about religion. No. We're talking about spirituality, and whether it's a humanist approach that this is just the right thing to do for another human being, or a specific religious guideline, it does have a tremendous impact. And to combine that with good medical knowledge, good information about resources available in the community, that's a dynamite combination. I want to just pull back a little bit. The show is on the past, present, and future of geriatric care, and we touched on a lot of different aspects right now. Now, I did a little research to find out how long the changes of aging have been documented in medical texts and literature. And I went as far back as a text by Cicero, and this was 44 BCE. This was the year after Julius Caesar was assassinated that Cicero wrote this book, and it's called De Senectute. And a translation of that Latin means basically on aging matters. There's a link on the website, both to the Network and Aging website, and also a link to the Latin of Cicero's text. I couldn't find an English translation on the web. That you can buy from Loeb, L-O-E-B, historical library. I think it's part of the Harvard Classics.
But you could read it in the original Latin, couldn't you?
I was working my way through it. It was a little slow, but they took Latin out of the medical school curriculum for some reason. Otherwise, I'd be golden. But what I found was Cicero's book, Shakespeare, in As You Like It, has the very famous passages, The Seven Ages of Man. That was written in 1598 or so. Thomas Jameson wrote a book called The Essays on the Changes of the Human Body at Its Different Ages, the Diseases to Which It is Predisposed in Each Period of Life, and the Physiological Principles of Its Longevity. That was written in 1811. Dr. Nasher, Ignatz Nasher's book, Geriatrics, and this man was, what I read, the first to term to coin the term geriatrics. He wrote that in 1914. Then there's a book by Mr. Grumman, a book on the roots of modern gerontology, which is a compilation of different sources that delve into how long gerontology and geriatrics has been around. That was written in 1979. And then we come to the common era, if you will, in geriatrics. And Dr. Calkins wrote a book and edited a book called The Practice of Geriatrics. I believe the first edition was 1986, and a second edition was 1992. So that's kind of the time frame that we have in which geriatrics and the problems of aging has at least been in the text. Now, I don't know if, Dr. Calkins, you have any perspective on the history of geriatrics, if you can go back before Cicero and what may have been going on in ancient Egypt or ancient China.
No.
I wasn't able to research that, but these are some very provocative things for me.
I'm not able to give you more comments on the ancient history, but there have been a number of people who have been concerned about geriatrics and medical people who are concerned about geriatrics and have made a commitment to that field over the past 15 or 20, maybe 25 years. The crux, however, comes when, at least from the point of view of education and coordinated research, the crux comes when universities will develop academic research educational training programs in the field of geriatrics. And as I say, that began in this country about 1970. And again, our group, it began really about 1980. And our group, which started about 1978, was the seventh, so that it was about that period. And that is now developed so that I would say that at least half or two-thirds of the medical schools or more will have academic programs in geriatrics. And the National Institutes on Aging, which provides a great deal of the funding that goes into basic research in different fields and in scientific training and the like. The National Institutes of Health created the National Institutes of Aging, and that was perhaps about 1990. Dr. T. Franklin Williams, who was at Rochester next door, was the director of that institute. Not the first director, but the second director, and has made a strong commitment to this field.
Yeah, I think certainly having it recognized nationally as an institute in the National Institutes of Health is key to recognition and funding as well,
and
to get money
problems
going.
Such as Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and other neurologic diseases of aging and the whole issue of osteoporosis and bone physiology and so on, the issue of rheumatic diseases in older people, and of course all of the individual specialties confront a different ball game when they get in working with people who are in age 75 and so on and older.
Now, these are medical areas that...
These are medical areas.
Now, and there's also been tremendous research done in non-hardcore medical areas, mood disorders, sociology of aging. Bev, what can you say about that, especially with regard to the organization that you're involved with and where it's gotten the impetus to do the things that it's doing?
Well, certainly the Network in Aging works very closely with the State University of New York at Buffalo, where actually our office is actually housed in Kimball Tower. And I think that was of the university understanding that all the different disciplines really understand this issue. The reality of life, that we all are getting older, and through we're seeing citizens being much better lives. It's not just a medical issue. We have a who was really very healthy. But if she did not have the social network through the senior citizen centers and her groups, very depressed old woman. She is a 90-year-old woman who has a vibrant enthusiasm for life. She did lose her vision through macular degeneration. She's very hard of hearing, but she line dances four times a week and goes out and entertains at different senior centers and nursing homes or wherever. So she, you know, has the opportunity through all of these services available in our community to have a quality of life that she probably would not have.
I have a 95-year-old patient who uses web TV to stay in touch with the far outside world, but otherwise is quite independent. You would never guess that she was 95 years
right.
old.
I'd like to just build on this, on your comment there, because emphasizing that although my own perspective relates more to the medical side, all of the health science schools and all of the disciplines have major challenges in the field of aging, not only the social disciplines, but dentistry has a very important role and an active role, and Dr. Jenko, one of the investigators, key investigator at our university mm-hmm. in dentistry, has discovered that dental infections, gingivitis, and so on and so forth, have a very important role to coronary heart disease and so on. And in our programs, we combined our fellowship training with for our physicians with also a fellowship training program for dentists. And now the one at Rochester has one for psychologists and of course the nursing field is very actively involved.
Mm-hmm.
So that all the health science fields as well as the social support networks are involved.
And beyond that, too, architecture. I believe
yes.
your daughter, Dr. Calkins,
your niece
wrote a book on variable architecture that would allow an older person to stay living where they were but have the architecture change around them rather than them move to a new place of living.
And that's a very critical piece. Because oftentimes, especially if it's an older home, the bathrooms are very small and narrow. Now, all of a sudden, when you have a member of the household who requires a walker or a wheelchair, you need to look at actually structurally changing so that they can gain access to, obviously, the bathroom is a very important room, but to be able to then allow them to remain in their home. And there are architects, there are occupational therapists who are specializing in that area and working very closely with people who do the work, the hands-on work. So with, you know, those are all very important things, too. The Center for Assistive Technology, to be able to offer people the ability to eat, even though they have very bad Parkinson's and lots of tremors. Or for the person who has, for example, my dad, very severe arthritis in his hands. And one of his greatest challenges, because he's a very, he likes to dress well, he can't put on a tie, so he needs to have the assistance of buttonholers to be able to button his buttons. But otherwise, he's a very healthy person. So it's those little things that we're learning through all of this research and all of the different disciplines that help our seniors to be able to age well.
Dr. Coggan, before we go to the break, what area do you see that hasn't been developed enough that should be brought into this aging geriatric gerontology fold? Geriatrics being the medical care of older people, gerontology, the study of aging itself. Are there key areas that have been resistant, that just for whatever reason have not been pulled in that we need to focus on?
Well,
maybe someone's
area
out there.
That has been to some extent pulled in that but shouldn't be mentioned at least is the concept of interdisciplinary teams. I think you made brief reference to that, and you did also. As these disciplines work together, a lot of thought has gone into what structure will most effectively lead to a good coordinated program.
Mm-hmm.
And
what about public health? Public health, there seems to be smidgens of things out there of a public health effort directed specifically towards an older population, but it seems disproportionate to the needs and to the percentage of older people
You've made a very important point there. And in our Department of Medicine, we felt years ago that medicine should relate not only to individual patients and problems, but also to the community base that groups of patients that will give us lessons about the course of disease and ways to prevent disease and so on and so forth. And the field of clinical epidemiology has developed, and one of our former members, Dr. David Sackett, is now is probably one of the world's leading figures in medical epidemiology.
Explain what
Oxford
that is.
University.
Explain what that is and
what
benefit
it can
have.
Well, that has to do with looking at how do you look at data from groups of patients that will begin to give you clues to some of the causative factors that are at work and factors that influence the course of a disease. An example has to do with the respiratory field. There's a Dr. Lugaba, a physician at the Buffalo General Hospital and University, is very much involved in this and has discovered that there are certain areas of the Western New York community that have a very much higher frequency of asthma and respiratory diseases than others. And they're not just the areas that happen to sit beside a given factory or something or other. They may be unexpectedly, there will be areas that will, again, present huge problems of that are overlooked if you just look at the individual patient walking in the door. Mm-hmm. But when you begin to look collectively, you begin to find that these patients have something to tell us. Well, he discovered that the patients in the Black Rock area have a terrific amount of asthma and respiratory illness and all, and it comes from the trucks coming off the bridge and waiting to get passed in their customs and so on and so forth. The fumes and all go all over the place and all. Of course, the first place they go to is a certain nursing home that happens to be located there about 40 feet from from that site. And that certain nursing home has built facilities now in the suburbs and other areas. I don't know what it's doing about the fumes and all in that facility. But, I mean, epidemiology would bring these kinds of problems into the picture. Now, in our school, in our university, we have a very strong epidemiology program that the Department of Social Preventive Medicine has been traditionally very strong and had a strong relationship with the Roswell Park in the old days, and now it still has that relationship. And, of course, the epidemiological causative factors and aspects of cancer and so on are very important. But that school is now, that department has now got a public health school in our university, and one of the young doctors in the field that I'm particularly working in now, rheumatology, is now getting graduate training in epidemiology so she can understand more about some of the epidemiologic factors that are influencing arthritis and so forth. So that's a very important area, and I'm glad you mentioned it, and it is getting attention, but it certainly, I'm sure, could do with a greater emphasis. I don't think our students, they get instruction in how do you work with the statistics and analyze statistics and so on, but I don't think they get a feeling for the interface of medicine and the community. I don't think they get that. and I think they really should. The other thing you need to do is to get a better feeling again of the relationship of the disciplines. And I used to, when I would make rounds on a given floor, would ask an intern and all how things are going and all, and what's the name of the head nurse on the floor or whatnot. And often an intern will be working for a month on a given floor and not know the name of the head nurse, who would be the key person in making that young guy's or woman's life livable, in the help that person needs and gets, and wouldn't even know their name. So the medicine needs to get off its high hat a little bit and get to feeling a little bit more commonality with the human race and these students that need to realize that they're just part of a range of people that are all contributing to making patients better. I don't think they fully have that yet.
With that, let's go to the break. This will be Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind, and I want you to listen to it with how it might be a metaphor for where we're going with the care of older people. Be right back.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
It's amazing how a 1960s song can have new relevance when you listen to it carefully. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. We're back with What Should You Expect at Your Age? And in the second half of the show, we're going to continue our discussion about the current state of aging and get into what the future might hold for us. I have with me again Dr. Evan Calkins, who I proudly anoint the father of geriatrics in Western New York, though he very modestly handed it off to someone whose name I have to research. And Bev Caballa, who's doing fantastic things at the Network in Aging of Western New York. If you want to call in and ask questions, we're here to answer your calls. The phone number is 855-6848. What about funding? Big problem all the time for everything, and especially for healthcare, and especially for healthcare for older adults. Bev, What do you see from your perspective as president of the network?
Well, certainly, we recently had a town meeting where we had Senator Golden and Assemblyman Engelbreit, who are both chairmen of their committees on aging in New York State. They didn't have any golden parachute that they could tell us, but they certainly know that, and they talked about, you know, changes that need to happen with Medicaid. But I think what it really boils down to is that we don't really have a strong public policy on the issues of funding. And until we really get to a place where we understand how we're going to be able to manage the costs of aging, healthcare costs, but also the whole question of Social Security and where does that go, and how do we save that system as we baby boomers approach retirement. It's a very complex question that no one seems to have any real good answers for. And I think that in probably the next decade, that's going to be one of the great conundrums that we need to come to terms with. Because I think that as a society, we believe that we have a responsibility to our elders, but we haven't figured out how we're going to pay for it.
Dr. Calkins, you've been in the middle of budgets and funding in all different ways throughout your career. Where do we stand now?
Well, one aspect of budget and funding that everybody is going to be concerned about or is concerned about has to do with this horrendous catastrophe in the Erie County financial system. And the wasteful, thoughtless, poor planning that our elected officials have carried out in terms of all aspects of the supportive role of government, police, fire, libraries, the arts, and so on, all have important dependency on certain public support. That involves public trust, and it involves a sensible type of organization. So I think a first step that most of Western New Yorkers must be thinking about rests right in our own county and city governments and small town governments. And as I see it, the elected official who is getting votes and so on and so forth and using various methods of patronage and all to build his or her structure, I personally think that is no longer the type of person that is going to be able to efficiently manage a regional system of organized services. We look at what Niagara Falls is doing with the Hamilton Niagara Falls Peninsula organizational system there, incorporating several cities and regions and all. Now, I don't know what the structure is, but I bet you that they have a board of trustee type of function, but that there's a paid manager that must manage this vast enterprise. I can't imagine somebody's going to be running for office and suddenly find himself with that job. But be that as it may, Toronto also has a huge district that it is involved in and so on. And in this country, there are more and more cities. We read in the newspaper about the future plans of Buffalo, and I think we have to get off a dime and realize the present system is positively not working, and it's not a matter of just putting little patches. It's got to be redeveloped in some sensible fashion. President Greiner is taking a real lead role, I think, and there are several other people that are taking a lead role, and that has to be basic, I think, to funding of all fields and support to kids and adolescents and the whole structure of the life.
Well, one thing that disturbed me that I read recently is the cutback in funding to adult care facilities. And what this has caused is adult care facilities, adult homes, an intermediate level of care, someone who can't quite manage it in their own home but isn't ready for a nursing home, it's forced many of these adult care facilities to close. So where do these people go? They end up going to nursing homes because they can't go back home. What does that result in? It results in actually $42 million more paid out in nursing home funds than what was paid before. So in restricting money to adult care facilities, it was felt to be a cost-saving measure. It actually backfired and resulted in a $42 million hit because of shifting care to a nursing home setting, in a setting that's not appropriate for the people that had to go there.
What type of organizations have been unfunded? I mean, what type of organization?
So for someone who has spent their resources and then need to go on SSI in order to live in an adult home, that reimbursement is limited to the $28 a day. And at our town meeting, I believe that it was Assemblyman Engelbright who said, you know, I can't even put my dog in a kennel for more money than, you know, less money than that. They certainly have some legislation pending in Albany, is my understanding, to increase that rate. But you're right. What it does, it has the effect of forcing people into nursing homes when they don't need to be there just because they don't have the resources to privately pay. So that, A, we're having people in inappropriate settings. B, really nursing homes are going to be facing another issue, and that is because that individual is a low care need person, so the Medicaid reimbursement to the nursing home is not even adequate to cover the costs that they have. So that many nursing homes are getting into trouble now because they can't afford to provide the care that they're required to provide under the regulations because the reimbursement rate is so low. So it really is this vicious cycle of issues and concerns that on the one hand, the government doesn't want to raise the SSI rate, but then you've got, you know, the trickle-down effect of causing a greater burden on basically taxpayers or the Medicaid system because they're forced to be put into a nursing home.
Over the past couple of years, I've conceptualized something I coined grassroots geriatrics, and we were talking about that beforehand, and it involves patients, caregivers taking back some of the responsibility. And it's not that people aren't working very hard out there to stay in their own places, that families aren't helping people and struggling along and being frustrated, and in some cases, families and lives being torn apart by the difficulties in doing it. But I feel we need to offer tools to empower people at the grassroots level. And I have on the Grassroots Geriatrics website that I put together, grassrootsgeriatrics.org, I take off from President Kennedy's inaugural speech. And I state, ask not what your doctor can do for you, ask what you can do for your doctor. And this is taking self-assessment tools, and I'm trying to promote that for older people. But we need a larger force to promote it and encourage it and make sure that people get it and fill it out and bring it to their doctor. And this would provide a profile for a doctor who knows little about geriatrics, could now take a look at this packet of information that deals specifically with key geriatric issues. It helps to educate the patient and family in what things can be helped, that these aren't dead ends, that their incontinence is not a plague of aging, that there's nothing that can be done about, that depression is to be expected because you're old and what do you have to expect at your age? Things like this, or that they're not able to function in certain areas, and that's also part of aging, that you just have to struggle along. No, there's help out there to be had. And this is very inexpensive, grassroots. You involve people who would be more than willing to put the effort into such things. And that's a direction I would like to see developed. I think it has benefit in that everyone gets involved. It educates. It ultimately provides better care. And it's very inexpensive. Any comments about low-cost intervention?
I know that several very cutting-edge geriatricians are concerned about this, interested in this, and the question of educational programs for care providers is really attracted their interest, and they have developed some very excellent programs to educational programs to really help the care provider. I wish I could think of the name of the fellow at, in Florida that's been particularly active in this, but there are very good programs that are coming on deck, and I think you're absolutely correct.
We do have some programs here locally. The Erie County Department of Senior Services and the Niagara Caregiver Coalition has put together some caregiver education, powerful tools for caregivers, and it's a 7-part series where it really helps the caregiver to learn how to access services, but also how to manage their own stress, puts them in touch with support groups, and actually gives them increased tools so that they can better manage the caregiving that they're providing. Because if we were to lose these informal caregivers, it would cost billions of dollars to our healthcare system.
How is that provided? Is it in written form, or is it on the internet? Or?
It's actually a classroom. It's hosted at different sites around Erie County. I'm sure that someone could contact the Erie County Department of Senior Services, their caregiver coalition, and they would be able to give them a list of the sites where this training is being provided. I know, for example, Schofield has done it, the nursing home in Kenmore. But it is something that, not directly through the network, but through certainly the coalition of providers through the Network in Aging and the Niagara Caregivers Network, these have been developed and are being provided. Because there is so much that we need to do to get the word out to caregivers. And certainly in my role as a care manager, I think that's the critical thing that I do, is really go in and help families to understand what there is available to them, how to access it, and sometimes even walking with them hand in hand so that they can get to the right doctor. Because I can't tell you how many times I've been frustrated when someone that I know will go to their family physician that they've gone to for years with concerns about a memory impairment, and they're told that, well, it's just aging. And it's not always just aging. You know, that really is something that needs to be looked at and looked at well. And that's a great, I believe, a great disservice to both the patient and the family to not have that explored. And I don't think that it's something that the physician does out of not caring, but I think so many times they don't have the training, they don't have the understanding of aging and what's really going on. And I think the other challenge that many family physicians have is that it takes a lot of times to sometimes interview and to assess an elder, because maybe the vision is not so good, their hearing is not so good, and if they've come in on their own, it can be very difficult to communicate with them. So it's certainly one of the things that I recommend is that a family member go with the elder so that at least you're getting full representation of the information that's gotten from the physician. But it's a challenge.
I think the dynamics is going to change somewhat over the coming years as the baby boomers are the ones in this aging group more comfortable with technology and seeking out information, not satisfied with the status quo. And there'll be pressure from that end to force that a lot of these issues get dealt with, if not monetarily, but also just because that's what people will need and demand.
The problem is that the primary care physicians back against the wall, most of them have got a real struggle to keep the economics of their practice mm-hmm. going. Mm-hmm. They have to cut down their time with patients to 10 or 15 minutes or something, mm-hmm. whereas it takes a good hour to make any real progress, even for second or third visits with mm-hmm. issues of this sort. And they throw up their hands. They just don't know what in heaven's name to do. And I think that a real need is to think of and develop ways to help these primary care physicians begin to look at or address bring to their patient's attention this coordinated care and framework that you're talking about. And we were discussing earlier the concept that perhaps some centers could be developed that would provide an opportunity for patients to go or for physicians to refer their patient where they could get overall assessment of a functional assessment, et cetera, mm-hmm. some understanding of the sorts of disciplines that would help them and get guidance in organizing a program of comprehensive care. Because to have a beleaguered primary care physician suddenly be inspired enough to do that and have the time and all the rest of it is just not working.
And I think that's where we've mentioned it before, that interdisciplinary approach is so critical, that to really have all of the disciplines be able to participate in that assessment process, whether it's an OT, a PT, social worker, nurse, certainly nutritionist, and that's potentially where kind of your grassroots assessment could certainly be something that a client or a patient and their family could go to the physician's office armed with. So at least then the physician has the ability to review that information, maybe cutting down some of the time that he needs to spend with that patient, but then also having the ability to have other disciplines really review that information as well.
And I think if we had the billions of dollars that the drug companies have mm-hmm. to promote the medications on the television, that patients promptly take that information, go to the doctor and say, what about this? They say this is going to cure me, that this is the better than what you're giving me. If we had the billions to say, this is the assessment that you have to do for yourself, bring it to your doctor, and demand that your doctor does something about it. That's the parallel that, mm-hmm. that I see that needs to happen. And how can we work together with all of our great interest and dedication, not a for-profit motive, clearly,
right.
but a for-health motive, just trying to make things a little better for older people.
Mm-hmm.
In the last few minutes, I just want to touch on the future. And there's anti-aging medicine movements out there. There was recently an article in Technology Review, Can We Live Together? This is MIT's monthly magazine. And there was an article written by Sherwin Nuland, a very well-regarded physician who's written some fantastic books. He interviewed a man who believes within 20, 25 years, with concerted effort, that we can develop the science to stop aging. I want to know, when can I hang up my hat as a geriatrician and start studying how to be an eternatrician? Any comments on that?
Eternatrician. Wow. I'm not sure that I want to be here forever. You know, I mentioned my 90-year-old mother-in-law, and her goal was always to be 90. Well, now it's 100, as long as she can live well. I guess if we can live well, have our minds, you know, be able to enjoy family life, you know, all of that. But I'm not sure that we were meant to be here forever.
Well, so, you get into the philosophical yeah. and spiritual answers yeah. or discussion about those questions. But, you know, let's face it, I think to myself, 100 years from now, doctors are going to be saying, that Dr. Stahl and all the docs back then, they had to deal with Alzheimer's disease, they had to deal with cancer, they had to deal with diabetes. What are the docs 100 years from now going to be dealing with? Is the anti-aging remedies that are being proposed? A lot of it is advertising, not mm-hmm. based in science, and mm-hmm. People out to make a buck, clearly, on this population that's maybe afraid of dying, afraid of getting older, denies dying more than people 100 years ago denied dying, because they knew that dying was part of life.
I think that's certainly central to the American culture, where we really deny aging, you know, whether we don't want to believe that we're going to get older, but it's certainly something that I think we all need to come to terms with at some level or another.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. We'll leave that for the audience to answer. And thanks so much to Dr. Calkins and Mrs. Kubala for being with me today. I'm on vacation at the beginning of May, so I'll either run highlights of previous shows or a previous show, or take a month off from the show. In June, the topic will be, should you still be on the road? Safe driving as you get older. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. See you then.
That's it.
Till 2:45, would you lock the door?